CoinWorld Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about CoinWorld Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.
Welcome to the CoinWorld Podcast with your host, Jeff Stark.
And as I've said from day one of this show, this is a big tent hobby. There's a lot of room for folks.
And Larry Jewett.
And learning has been such a tremendous amount of this journey.
The CoinWorld Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome once again to the CoinWorld Podcast. As we're set for another episode here, as we are hurtling toward that magic 200 mark. I think of 200, I think of the bicentennial, I think of the fact that I'm still getting bicentennial quarters. Oh yeah, I'm Larry Jewett.
And I'm Jeff Stark. And we are, yeah, just a few episodes away from a big milestone. We want to thank everyone out there in podcast land for listening, for telling your friends, for sending ideas, for being supporters in general, and all that. So, you know, in fact, today you're going to, in this episode, we have an interview with a podcast listener, but Wes Bricker is much more than that. We'll get into that in just a bit.
I got to ask you, though, because, I mean, looking back here, when you and Chris Bullfinch decided to put the CoinWorld Podcast together, and of course, many of our listeners may not have been there for the first show, first 10 shows, first 100 shows, whatever the case may be. Did you ever in your wildest dreams, I know you can't speak for Chris, but for yourself, did you ever in your wildest dreams imagine that you were going to be at 200 and still going?
I didn't know if we'd still be here. I mean, not that the podcast wouldn't last, but just, you know, you never know what's in store. We don't know the future, right? And it was one of those things where we were excited to get going. And once we jumped in, it was every week, let's do this, let's do this, let's do this. What are we going to talk about? And the first 50 or so shows, at least, there was lots of folks. We had ideas about who we were going to talk to and all that. And, you know, when you're hitting almost 200, it's harder to find voices that haven't already shared lessons with the listeners. But you know, we and some folks will go back to the well a few times. But the good news is there's always something going on in the hobby, and I can tell you that some of the things we have sort of lined up are going to be really cool, really timely, really fun. And, you know, so that's any concern I had about, you know, are we going to run out of topics before, you know, we hit 100, 200, whatever, that has abated.
And one of the things that I want to talk about briefly here, just before we completely eliminate the past. We'll come back to the past a little later on in other segments of the program, but also want to give a shout out, if he's still listening to us, is our good friend Brian Hertel, because I'm sure that he played a pivotal role in helping you guys get this thing underway.
So, oh, absolutely.
Yeah, when I joined, I mean, he was a saint to me. He really helped a lot, and I appreciate all that he did. Wish him well.
Absolutely, absolutely. Brian was the unsung hero of those first, 150, whatever, 170, whatever it was. I don't remember, but he definitely is appreciated and missed. So thank you for not calling me out, but for calling that out, for bringing that to the fore, as it were, because it should not go unnoted. So
yeah. But Dal, when we talked earlier a little bit about, it's exciting of all the different subjects that possibly come up here. But, you know, there are some events coming up that are really going to open up opportunities for us as in any side of the numismatic pursuit, whether you're looking to go to shows, whether you're looking to add your collection through the auctions or through the private sales, that type of thing. I mean, I personally, when you hear this, I'm probably in Schaumburg, Illinois at the Central States Numismatic Society Convention. and having a great old time. I'm not intending to rub that in since you won't be there this time, but you know that's coming up. But you're going to be holding down the home base because, while it's not a numismatic event, there's going to be historic events that hopefully we're going to. Can you let the cat out of the bag yet?
I don't want to say anything just yet. I don't mean to be a tease. Until it comes through, and I will say, though, as we are recording this show, I am on the cusp of a fantastic, hopefully, interview. And how much do I love doing the podcast? This is going to require me getting up at 4:45 a.m. to do. So just remember that when you hear it, hopefully, if it all comes together as we plan. There's, you know, you have to work around crazy schedules with people. And, you know, we cover events around the world numismatically, and the hobby never sleeps. Hopefully, I will get a little bit of sleep. Hopefully, we're not putting you to sleep, though, because we have a great interview with Wes Bricker of PwC, that's PricewaterhouseCoopers. We're talking a lot about current events. We're talking about history. I think it's time to to open up those history books, hey?
Yeah, let's go for that. I mean, let's look back at some of the great events that have helped shape this hobby or business, whatever the case may be, as we continue to add events to our roles with the events of 2023. But going back in time, set the stage for what we're getting to enjoy today.
So I look back in the week that was by the late Fred Reed, and it was tough this time to come up with something that I thought was significant enough. I mean, one of the things was a sale of a gold collection of Colonel or C.W. Green. I don't know if that's Colonel Green because he was Colonel E.H.R. Green. So I don't think that was it. But the thing that jumped out to me as probably the most fun to talk about, most interesting, was the April 26, 1861 report in the New York World newspaper. That newspaper reported the seizure the day previous of 18 Confederate States of America banknote printing plates. Where did they seize these printing plates? At the offices of the American Banknote Company. They also seized plates for the so-called Montgomery notes. I believe these were issued through at Montgomery, Alabama, in the Confederacy. And these plates were at the offices of the National Banknote Company. And that event, April 26th, was the report. So the seizure was the day before, April 25. You're talking about what the American, the Civil War was April 15 to 18 to April 9. Is that right? So this was just about 10 days after the start of the war, and the intermingling of economics and the relationship, the cooperation of Northern companies with entities in the South was a big deal. And so, you know, there's a whole body of research about how some of these, the banknote companies cooperated with the Confederacy and circumvented the law and all that. It's a fascinating tale from American history, not just numismatic history. So that's what jumped out to me this week in numismatic history.
Well, to me, that's almost a borderline treasonous act. But I mean, obviously, if it was within the law, it's still the spirit of the law. And knowing that we were at odds with another entity, then put it into a position like that. Of course, it was such a fledgling skirmish at the time. It would go 4 years, but in 1861, it was still somewhat new. And the news didn't travel as quickly, so there may have been elements of it. But the fact that they had these plates already made up, and of course there were states that had withdrawn from the Union prior to the Fort Sumter situation. So, I mean, just looking at that period of history, it's always fascinating. There's always more to learn, and that's why the dealers in Confederate currency and the fractional currency of the era and that type of thing, always fascinating stories there for sure. And we really enjoy that one. So I think that was a good choice, especially because, you know, we talk about history being made and history being a part of what drives a lot of the numismatic efforts. And I think that was a good choice right there. So what about going back in a little more recent history, perhaps?
Sure. So this week in Coin World history, we're looking at the issue April 26, 1978. 78 was important to Mr. Bricker, he said, for some family reasons. And it also happens to be the centennial of his favorite coin, the 1878 trade dollar. You'll get to hear about that in just a bit. And what was in this issue that jumped out at me? Well, it's always fun to see Jesse Owens, an Olympian. It's always fun to see an Olympian with a coin. And the photo on the cover of this issue of Coin World shows Olympic great Jesse Owens with an official from the Paramount International Coin Corporation, which was headquartered in Englewood, Ohio, a suburb of Dayton, so about 30 to 40 minutes from the home offices of Amos Media. So what did he have? Well, he had a silver $25 coin from Jamaica for a coronation of a new ruler in Jamaica, I guess. It speaks to this. The reason I highlight this was because I think there's such a difference the way international coins are marketed today here in the U.S. On one hand, but on another, it's not really any different. So Paramount was a huge company that did all sorts of projects, different coin sets from various countries around the world. They did medallic series here in the U.S. And if you have ever had the privilege of looking at the pages of Coin World from that era, you see all sorts of enormous ads touting these programs. It's very interesting to see. I've learned a lot just by looking at the ads in back issues. There's still some dominant players today in distributing world coins, but, you know, they don't need to run a print ad. Who runs a print ad? I mean, we're fortunate for those folks who still do. And, you know, there's a lot of great advertising support and partners for Coin World, but the number of folks who are doing that is certainly much, much smaller than back in the day. They're reaching them through the website, their own website, right? And there's so many new products coming out today that if you ran a print ad, you'd need page after page after page to show all these. There's just hundreds of coins coming out every month. It's quite a thing to understand when, you know, you look at the landscape and go, what is the market today and how does that compare? And, you know, I've made this point in talks to several coin clubs around the country that, you know, the market is the long tail book. I want to say Chris Anderson, but the long tail, the idea that you can sell a small number of widgets, if you will, products. You can sell a small number of a high number. That is, you have thousands of different product SKUs or whatever product items. You don't have to sell that many of each of those, but when you add it all up, you have an aggregate sales total that's far greater. You know, back in the day in Canada and the US, you had the annual set and maybe one other thing, And they sold sometimes several million of these every year. Well, now the annual set is just one product among 100 others, if not more, you know, when you look at something like some place like Canada. So it's fascinating to think about that and just to understand the evolution of the business and retail in general. And of course, you know, it doesn't hurt to have an Olympian promoting numismatics in that capacity. So that's what stood out to me. It was certainly not, there was a headline right next to it about a bill that had been introduced in the House that would permit U.S. bullion coins. Well, these weren't really coins. These were medallions, and they had some weird basis of, you know, the highest unit would be 1.5 troy ounces, and the other three would be like 3/4 of an ounce and 3/20 of an ounce. It was really bizarre, and it's almost too confusing to try to explain in this format. And obviously, in hindsight, you go, "Oh, well, that never went anywhere." You know, so we could have talked about that in depth, but I think that was one of those moments that was so fleeting that it barely registers today. So it was better to look at something with a little more, a broader view, if you will. That's what jumped out to me. I hope that was sufficient and I didn't get too far out of line with it.
Well, and you did not, and we appreciate the information. But on that very same issue, just a few pages back from there, we had a couple of letters that were a point counterpoint type thing. And one of the first letters says claims age discrimination. And the letter reads, "I am writing this letter to protest what I believe to be unfair discrimination on the part of the American Numismatic Society. I will receive my Master of Arts degree from Yale University this May, and next year will continue my graduate studies at Oxford. I will be the first person in the history of Yale to be granted my MA only 3 years after graduation from high school. I have been a coin collector for many years and have written numerous articles on numismatic subjects. I have served on the board of editors of the Young Numismatist and am currently assistant curator of the Yale Numismatic Collection. Yet when I applied for acceptance to the ANS Summer Seminar in Numismatics, I was rejected largely because it was felt that my application was not acceptable because I'm only 18 years old. Although technically not a young numismatist now, I still feel that this is a classic illustration of the ways in which many organizations still discriminate against younger numismatists. I applaud the efforts of those institutions and persons who struggle to combat this discrimination, but at the same time, I fear that it will never pass. While at Oxford, I hope to continue to demonstrate, as I have always tried, that chronological age is not necessarily the optimal determinant of a student's ability." The letter was signed by James B. Hicks of New Haven, Connecticut. Now, that's brought up because the following letter was the response from the American Numismatic Society. And it reads as follows: "Mr. Hicks's protest with regard to alleged discrimination in admission to the ANS Summer Seminar is, on the face of it, absurd, since any valid charge of discrimination can only be made if one knows the quality of the competition. Each year, we receive between 35 and 40 applications for the Summer Seminar program, of which the great majority are from fully qualified candidates. We're able to accept only 10 to 12 students, which means that many applicants with acceptable qualifications must unfortunately be rejected. The final decision is based on the votes of a 9-member committee consisting of ANS curators and university professors. What factors influence their unanimous rejection of Mr. Hicks's application is something which only they can answer individually. It's likely that age was a determining consideration, since in the past we have tended, all other things being equal, to give preferential treatment to candidates of more advanced graduate status who might not have another opportunity to take advantage of the summer seminar." And that was from Margaret Thompson, at the time the chief curator of the ANS in New York City. So there you had it. It was a case of somebody thinking something might have happened, and we don't really know. Here we are, you know, 45 years later, don't really know how it all played out. So just interesting that it was in that forum that they utilized the point counterpoint. situation.
Sure, that's quite interesting. Again, you know, you might not have that tête-à-tête play out in the pages today, but I do want to shift gears now that we've looked at the coin world history and put you to the test, see if you can pass muster. Last episode, we were talking with Danny Spungen about Operation Bernhardt. So I wanted to know how many Operation Bernhardt notes, what was the total face value estimates of these counterfeit Bank of England notes? And fascinating topic, one of my favorites in the hobby. And so there are estimates out there of a range of how many, what the cumulative face value notes were printed. So I wonder what you believe that those numbers might be.
I mean, there's quite a range. I mean, depending upon your source, and Danny didn't address this, but I've heard from different things. And, you know, there was an opportunity to visit with them in the 2021 World's Fair of Money. And, you know, it's been around for a while. So we've heard different somewhere in the neighborhood. I mean, I've heard it over 120 million to like 300 million. So, I mean, it depends on what you're looking at here or how you slice it, I guess. But I mean, it could be, as I hear, it's up to like 300 million.
Yes. So your lower number was just a hair lower than what I've seen. I've seen reports that about 132.6 million pounds. And then I've seen the upper number of 300 million, exactly right. So I'm going to give you credit for that. You pretty much, I'd say you got a 96 or 97 out of 100 on that. You were really close.
That would be a 9.9 on the NGCX scale. Yep.
There you go. MS-68 or 69.
Woo! All right.
So this week, you know, in our interview with Mr. Bricker, you kind of threw in an aside, and it was, I took it as a challenge. He mentioned Charles Barber. And you said, oh, I'm sure Jeff's going to make a trivia question about that. So I took that as a challenge. William, in that discussion, we didn't get into their relationship. William is the father. Charles is the son. William died in 1879. Charles died in 1917. William is lesser known, but one of his pièce de résistance is the Amazonian pattern from 1872. Charles, I think, pièce de résistance, I mentioned it in the interview, was the Stella patterns. But that's not the question, because if it was, I just gave you the answer. Charles, of course, designed a suite of coins. And remember, he died in 1917. Those coins went out of circulation. Or rather, they were replaced with new designs. They still circulated just a year before. So did that, seeing his designs forced out of, replaced, did that kill him? No, just kidding. The serious question is, he designed coins for at least three other countries that I know of. I know of three countries that he designed coins for: Cuba and China and one other one. The one other one has a special connection to the United States. So what coins of this other country did he design? And, you know, bonus points if you can tell me the suite of those coins, the sweeping array of denominations. So that is the question for this week. Barber was the designer of the trade dollar, which was referenced. Actually, no, William Barber was the designer of the trade dollar, which I said Barber. I didn't tell you which one, so I was technically right. That's how we got into the whole Barber talk, shop talk, barbershop talk. So listen to the interview with Wes Bricker here to learn all about a journey in collecting and how there are applications in business and in life We had a great time hearing from him. Hope you do as well.
It's a great day to be on the Coin World podcast, and we're welcoming in today Wes Bricker, who's a leader at PwC, and he is not just a leader. He is a person who is an active collector, Coin World subscriber, Coin World podcast listener. I mean, I would have put those accolades ahead of the other one here, but that's just the way we want to go because, Wes, it's so great to have you on board here today, and thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Well, Larry and Jeff, it truly is a privilege and an honor to be with both of you, but also with your audience and our fellow coin collectors. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you today.
I would really like to start off by, and typically I guess I kind of lean on this because it allows us to give the audience a chance to get a better feel for who you are, because your collecting journey, everyone's collecting journey is unique. Tell us how your collecting journey started and where you are today.
Well, thanks, Larry. My collecting journey really starts with family. And I know many of us as coin collectors inherit not just coin collections, but also a love for coin collecting and the memories and the emotions that also come with that. My earliest memories start with my dad, who had a collection from his dad and his uncles stashed away in a small drawer in his desk. And I remember in my earliest memories going through those coins. They were, in that case, German coins, along with some U.S. coins, working my way through there. My grandfather was a real coin collector, also a notes collector, silver certificates and the like. My brother has a real wonderful collection and interest. And it was my brother and I are close. We were then. We continue to be. We're 1 year apart. And so it's something that enables us as families to connect. And I'm also a very proud dad of two sons and a daughter. And I'm happy to say all three of them enjoy tagging along to coin stores here in Virginia or going to shows from time to time. To me, it's something that is fun, it's educational, and it's something we can do as a family. That's a bit of where I've started on it.
So with the idea here that you've had the next generation getting them involved, it just, do they have the same interest that you would have? I mean, a lot of times we hear about the modern coins outweighing the classic coins. What are the interests and what do you find there?
You know, it is funny. I have a 10-year-old son, and several years ago, he was six at the time. He sat down at dinner and he said, I hear you and mom talking about Bitcoin. Is that the same thing as coin collecting?" We laughed. It's of course not exactly the same, but you know, we do get to this sort of question of what is a coin? How broadly to think about that? We're much more traditional minded. Apart from that conversation, the kids still do their Whitman folders. They have penny collections. My daughter, in fact, collects buffalo nickels, Indian head nickels in the 30s. Each of them have their own, you know, sort of small collection, their own sort of points. My middle son collects wheat pennies. My oldest, he'll collect a bit of a variety, but they're all sort of building their own collections, and so you know, from time to time, we'll sort of get them out and sort through them and so forth. Again, it's an opportunity for education, as well as we talk about, you know, what's the context of a coin and its role in society at the time. What were people thinking about at the time that the coin was issued?
So you said you have a 10-year-old. What are the ages of the other two children?
Yeah, a 10-year-old and then twin 7-year-olds. So we've been very blessed with two boys and a daughter. They're aligned in interest and couldn't be more different in sort of their personalities and approach. But the one sort of common denominator is that they have a common interest around coins.
And
so. Excuse me, Jeff. Let me just say, you know, when we talk about young numismatists, we always advise them to get a mentor. And obviously, with these being your children, you're the mentor. Do you find as a collector that they can somewhat be a mentor to you as well?
Their passion for understanding, I think, is really, really inspiring. So for me, it's what has taken me on is sort of a the importance of sort of talking about the context of the coin. All three of our kids are intensely curious. They're intensely curious about sort of why the world works and what is the system of exchange, and would people accumulate a particular coin? We had a summer sort of family trip to the Bureau of Printing and Engraving, and they were very curious about, well, what is the role of government with coining or coinage? Why can't we have private coins? And so I think their collections and their curiosity has also been good for me as a parent and as a mentor.
So you said you've been able to sort of incorporate some of the hobby into your family vacation time.
That's right. My wife as well has economics background, legal training. It is also of the, you know, intellectually curious and willing to explore. One of the other trips that we've made, you know, we've gone to Philadelphia, visit the Mint there. On our list, we have not done yet as a family. But hope to at some point is to visit the San Francisco Mint.
Indeed. And it's always great to know, because there was a period of time when we obviously couldn't go to these different places that have numismatic interests. And now that we're having that opportunity to get back into doing that, it's always great to have that there. But let's dig a little deeper on your interest here. I understand the trade dollar seems to be what really excites you. You were talking about that passion of your children. What about yours with this trade dollar?
The trade dollar is, I guess, my coin of interest. You know, it's been of interest to me because the trade dollar, as I'm sure many in our audience will know, The trade dollar was really connected to a much broader theme as our country was sort of coming into the industrial age. Cross-border trade was really important to the development of the U.S. and certainly has a place in American history. Minted from 1873 to 1885, it was post-Civil War. And as the country was was then trading with Asia and Europe. The question of how to most efficiently settle that trade was an important question, and silver was the precious metal that was commonly used. And so for me, the trade dollar sort of has that context of cross-border transaction. It's also interesting that the trade dollar was designed by William Barber, not the same as the Barber coins that's maybe sort of commonly understood as being designed by Charles Barber, but they share a last name. I don't know if they share a further relationship there. I don't think they do, but the trade dollar is one that 1878, which was the last year of its primary mintage. There are a couple of years beyond that where smaller lots were minted before they were bought back by the Treasury in 1887. So it's a coin because of its place in the development of the U.S., the development of international trade, and also the way policy comes together. You know, the trade dollar has a place in foreign exchange as well. As the U.S. Developed more silver mines and developed more silver, then the capacity to increase the amount or content of silver within trade dollars enabled the U.S. to more effectively negotiate for trade, particularly in China. And that was important as we were competing for the same goods that many in Europe were also competing for. But we were adjusting silver content to give the country an edge. So it's that sort of context that also applies in my professional life today, in accounting and professional services on a global scale. It enables me to sort of connect to what people were thinking about in the late 1800s as they were doing their best to really develop America as we know it today.
That's interesting there because number one, and I'll let Jeff ask his question, but I want to inject here that Jeff is probably going to use your information regarding Barber as one of our future trivia questions. So thank you for raising that. I'll give me a chance to do a little research onto that. Jeff, what you got for me?
Well, so I have to ask, because you mentioned the trade dollars, you know, application in trade, of course, and Asia and all that. What does your collecting scope look like? Do you include chop mark trade dollars? Or you referenced the small mintages, later issues. That's the proof issues, I believe. So
that's right.
Do you count those as part of your collection? Is that a something you search for? Are you limited to just the circulating stuff? Talk about how the parameters around your collection a little bit.
Yeah, great question, Jeff. So I do have a few chop marks, and maybe for the broader audience, when the U.S. would mint a trade dollar, and then would put that into circulation, oftentimes the recipient of that might be in China, might be in some other setting, would then restamp it with their own mark, and so you get commercial marks, you get country marks, and so I'm always on the hunt for trade dollars with chop marks. I've also gotten into the proof sets beyond 1878, But one of my favorite coins is actually the 1878 trade dollar. It was minted in Philadelphia. And that's of significance to me because 1978 is a year of significance in my own life and my family. So as I look at coin collecting, it's for me, 1878 is a very accessible year for trade dollars. It's very accessible for my kids also with trade dollars. We can find them at shows. They're more available at shows. We can trade them. So for me at this stage, my favorite year is 1878.
So you're going to collect a whole roll of 1878 trade dollars.
I'm working on it. Yeah.
So I have to ask, because you talked about the interest in global trade, the $4 mm-hmm. Stella was created to sort of, you know, facilitate global trade. Is that the next target?
that's right. You know, I'm sure at some point my interest will move on. One of the things that just in terms of parameters, and I know we all have them. I have focused on silver coins, not gold. I have a few pieces in my collection that are gold, but I've focused on silver just as a parameter, because it's also like my as I grew up, I grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania, and in growing up, silver was a big reach for us, big reach. And so I think for me, silver, it will be an important part of my collection. Luxury was then, now, and still is something I view as, you know, a bit of a luxury element of my collection. Certainly a special place, but I guess that's what we all inherit a bit of parameters.
When you were talking earlier about the trade dollar, and you made mention of the fact that you know, you are in the business world, and the business world can be a highly competitive place sometimes. I think about in coin collecting, we have the competition, the registry sets, and information like that. But is there anything that coin collecting has taught you that allows you as a leader at PwC to do your job a little better?
Yeah, it's such a great question. The answer is yes. Coin collecting, you know, in many cases, I think, is based on trust. And trust is the currency of business. Another element so what does it take to build trust? What it takes, you know, all of us working together to be specific about the parameters of the market, to maintain honesty in the market, keeping, you know, counterfeit items out, to be fair and accurate and objective in grading. And so those are elements that I think are very translatable. Maybe at a more market level, the impact of markets, especially in an inflationary market, coin collecting can be certainly a good hedge of value, as purchasing power tends to raise the value of coins, but also the importance of maintaining a lot of, you know, a a wide group of buyers and sellers to keep a balanced and liquid market. Those concepts translate from coin collecting into the commercial world as well. But I would say maybe the common denominator of coin collecting as well as the corporate market is the human element. Like we're people transacting with people in the most sort of core sense. And so the way we communicate, the way we relate, the friendships that we develop, the candor and the honesty and the personal human side, I think that's what business leaders have as an obligation and aspiration, just the same as collectors do. That the human side is just as important as maybe the more technical aspects of coin collecting.
And you are successful because of your people and not creating levels of people by having the interaction. So a coin collector is a coin collector is a coin collector. One of the things I've really enjoyed about this hobby is you may not collect the same thing as I do, but I respect your collection just as you should respect mine. Do you find that many that you deal with on a daily basis are open-minded about coin collecting?
You know, it's interesting, Larry. The I love your point, and I agree with it, that coming from a space of curiosity and interest in understanding why someone has assembled the collection they've assembled and what's next for them, in order to learn, to be open-minded about learning. There's another word that oftentimes we use in society and certainly in business, diversity, the diversity of thought, the diversity of experience, the diversity of starting point, the diversity of parameters. Is someone a silver collector or a gold collector? What is their background? That diversity is what really enables us to come together in coin collecting as well as in business and society more generally. But it starts with curiosity and respect. And so one of the things, just to loop back a little bit to the kids, like we'll often visit estate sales, and that's a window into, you know, someone's view and collection and so forth. It's an opportunity to sort of have a discussion around legacy and passing things from one to another. And I find that diversity across generations is also a really important element of this.
When you mentioned at the top of the program that the coin collecting, your journey started, there were German coins involved in that. And of course, we've talked about international connection with the trade dollar. Are there interests in the world type coins?
Yeah, it's so my wife's family comes from South Korea. One of the world interests that we have, the kids and I and my wife to a certain degree, is collecting coins from anywhere where we've had family who have lived in that country, was born in a given country, and so we have coins from South Korea, we have coins from Germany, we have coins from England, of course, from the U.S. We've assembled sort of a category of coins that are connected to family as well.
Well, I know time is, you're a very, very busy man in your business world, and we're about running out of time here. So I've got one final question for you, Wes, and that is, how do you find the time to spend the time? Obviously, it's very important for your family, but how do you find the time from your busy non-9-to-5 job here? Because I'm sure it starts earlier and ends later. But how do you find the time to spend some time with your collecting and your collecting journey?
Well, there's always time for things that we're passionate about. I'm passionate about being a dad. I'm passionate about being a husband and a brother and a son. And coin collecting is something that is just woven into each of those roles. And so for me, it's something that we can find time for because it's important to just the way I engage with my family and the way we work together as a unit. That's how we find time. We prioritize it.
Well, and we're going to prioritize the opportunity to get you back on here because we certainly do appreciate the time you spent with us here and our listenership on the Coin World podcast. Wes Bricker from PwC, again, look out for those 1878 trade dollars. The last one I was offered was a counterfeit, so I didn't touch it. So thanks so much, Wes. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Larry and Jeff.
Thank you. Be well. That was our interview with Wes Bricker of PwC. We thank him for reaching out and taking the time to talk to us about his journey.
And especially thank him for his support of the Coin World podcast. But, you know, we all have busy lives, and this gentleman here is involved in helping assist with the operation of a major company here in the U.S. and still finding time to spend some time with his family and drive numismatics into other aspects of his life. And it's something that we all can derive lessons from. And we really appreciate the fact that he was able to spend some time with us and with you, our listeners here, and pass that message along. We really appreciate all of the support that we get throughout this. If you happen to be running around at Central States, please come over and say hi. Appreciate that. I know we've had opportunities to meet listeners in the past at some of the shows, and we're putting Jeff's travel schedule together. So you'll be seeing him out and about here sometime in the near future. In the meantime, I've got to go pack because I've got a lot of stuff to get ready, because while you're doing your interview coming up, I'm probably going to be on an airplane. So
absolutely.
I want everybody to enjoy what you're doing out there. It's a great time. It's a great hobby. It's a great business. It's great to be involved. And so until next time,
happy collecting.
Thank you for listening to the Coin World podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you next week.
Coin World Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about Coin World Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.